From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The big news in the Republican Party in the Obama years has been the rise of the Tea Party, strident opposition to the Obama administration, and a one-percenter association with the wealthy and inequality. Now a group of so-called reform conservatives says there has to be more than that, and they're laying it out. A 100-plus page manifesto of outreach to the struggling middle class. This hour on Point, the Republican Party and America's middle class. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you ready to turn to Republicans to bring back the middle class? What's the policy, the vision that would win your support? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. In late May, a group of prominent Republicans rolled out a 121-page policy handbook manifesto called Room to Grow, Conservative Reform for Limited Government and a Thriving Middle Class. It's being promoted by a group called the YG Network, YG as in Young Guns, with ties to Congressman Eric Cantor of Virginia. Two of the book's co-authors are with us today. From Washington, Yuval Levin, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, contributing editor to the National Review, the Weekly Standard, and founding editor of the quarterly journal National Affairs. Yuval Levin, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me.
And from Washington, Peter Wehner, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, contributor to Commentary Magazine. He was deputy director of speech writing for President George W. Bush. Peter Wehner, welcome back to you as well.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom. Thanks.
What's the circumstance that you're trying to address with this manifesto, policy handbook, call it what you will? Yuval, where are you headed here?
Well, the book is an attempt to put in one place some of the thinking that's been going on in the last few years that could form the backbone of a middle-class agenda for conservatives. A lot of conservatives in America in the last few years, for understandable reasons, have been focused on defense, have been concerned about what's going on in a Washington that is not under their control, and so have been trying to restrain federal spending, to contain some of the moves of the Obama administration, to explain to the public what they're opposed to. But we think that in order to win the public's trust in forthcoming elections, we have to not just tell the public what we're opposed to, but to tell the public what we want to do. And we have to not just show that we want to spend less on the Democrats' vision of government. We have to show what a conservative vision of government looks like and what it can do for the public. And so this is a book that, rather than begin from what the Obama administration has done or what's happened in Washington in the last few years, begins with the concerns of the middle class and then tries to offer a vision for how conservatives go about addressing problems, and then tries to offer an agenda. In other words, how that vision applied to those concerns can help the middle class and the poor and Americans in general deal with some of the enormous problems that we confront entering the 21st century, and also make the most of some of the extraordinary opportunities that we have. And so it's a book that starts with a sense of what the problem looks like, and then chapter by chapter offers a set of solutions on healthcare, on taxes, on education, on the safety net, tries to suggest what a different approach to solving problems can look like in practice.
Here's a little bit of this is Mike Lee of Utah, Republican senator, at last month's rollout, late last month, of this Room to Grow manifesto, talking about reform conservatism, harkening back here to Abraham Lincoln.
The whole purpose of the conservative reform agenda is to emphasize an understanding expressed by Abraham Lincoln in his first big address to Congress, when he said that the purpose of government is to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, and to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life.
Mike Lee there at the rollout of the manifesto. Peter Wehner, how did it come to be that in the last presidential election, Mitt Romney's campaign and the GOP, for that matter, came to be tightly associated, you and others have noted, not so much with the middle class, but with there was this makers and takers language out there. There was entrepreneurs, kind of, and everybody else. It even got all the way down to the sort of diss of the 47% with Mitt Romney. How did the party come to be associated with entrepreneurs rather than a broader section of the country?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the reason that it got associated with it is that conservatives, by and large, are concerned about big government and about what government does to civic character and to institutions, and they believe that during the Obama years, government has gotten much bigger, which I think demonstrably it has. And I think there's been a kind of overreaction among conservatives and a fear, a deep fear, that there is a kind of corrosion of that civic character. And so I think a lot of conservatives began to buy into this fairly dramatic situation or explanation of what's going on, these givers and takers. And I think that they sort of turned a little bit on the American people. And so what we're trying to do is to turn it back, and not to criticize or lecture or point fingers at the American people, but actually to try and understand what the problems are that they face, which are real and considerable, and then to try and come up with a series of policies to help them to address it.
It's interesting, this turn, what reform conservatism is or means, who's on board and who's not. You've got big names in here. Eric Cantor was at your rollout. Mike Lee, we heard there. Mitch McConnell was there. And talking about just this issue, saying, look, the middle class is more than entrepreneurs. Certainly entrepreneurs have long had a place in the GOP. Mitt Romney really celebrated that. Here was Mitch McConnell trying to turn to a bigger audience.
For most Americans whose daily concerns revolve around aging parents, long commutes, shrinking budgets, and obscenely high tuition bills, these hymns to entrepreneurism are, as a practical matter, largely irrelevant. And the audience for them is probably a lot smaller than we think.
So, Peter, I want to jump into the agenda here in just a moment, but if you're successful, what would that mean in terms of the party picking up the agenda that you're laying out here? Is there any commitment to do that? Is this a buffet table that Republican candidates can come and pick and choose from as they please? What's the idea here, Peter?
Well, I think the idea of it is that there would be an agenda that would be ready for candidates who believe in the agenda that we're after to embrace it and endorse it and run on it. This group and this effort is not to promote any single candidate or group of candidates. It's really, I think, a deeper than that, and it's an effort to try and put forward what we think is the proper conservative vision for American society and a governing agenda, and to have people pick it up. In terms of whether people will do it, my sense is that there is a market for this. I've noticed in really the last year, 15 months or so, an increase interest among Republican leaders in this kind of thing. And I actually think that an important and maybe a seminal moment was the government shutdown back in October, because that was a disaster. Many of us said in advance it would be a disaster. I think it proved to be a disaster for the Republican Party. And I think that it underscored and to some extent seared into the minds and imaginations of Republican office holders the importance of coming up with a real governing agenda, not just of, you know, cursing the night, but lighting candles. Let me just say one other thing, which is if you examine the polling evidence, what it shows is that people believe that the Republican Party is a principled party often, but that it's out of touch, and it's particularly out of touch with the middle class. Now, whether Republicans like it or not, if you go through the polling evidence, it shows that they believe consistently, even today, when Democrats are rather on the ropes and the president's on the ropes, but even today, they believe that Democrats identify and speak for and champion the middle class in a way that Republicans don't. That's a big problem. And if Republicans don't get that right, they're going to have a hard time winning presidential elections from here on out.
So let's hear it. Let's dive into some of this agenda. You've got contributors over, what, 8 or 9 different big areas that people would be concerned with. Maybe you can help us. You've all jumped in on employment policies. That's been front and center ever since the recession took so many jobs away. We saw the Obama push. Congress not always cooperative with that and sometimes very starkly in opposition. What would you propose as a reform conservative approach to full or fuller employment in this country?
Well, I think the key to diving into these particular policy ideas is to see how they're connected around a vision of how to solve problems. One of the contentions of the book is that one of the key differences between the left and the right is in how we go about approaching solving public problems, where the general sense on the left is often that government should act as a manager in addressing these kinds of problems, should try to manage society as a series of systems that need order and control. And what conservatives tend to say is that government should function in ways that empower society to address its own problems. That is, that creates space for the institutions of society, for the institutions that sit between the individual and the government, to function from the bottom up and to address problems. And so what you find is not management, but more like empowerment, more like creating the circumstances for people to address problems. And so when you think about employment, the basic difference, the basic distinction is that it's not about moving money around, and it's not about creating jobs from the center, and it's not about fundamentally believing that the unemployment benefit is the solution to the unemployment problem. It's first and foremost that the problem is that our economy is not sufficiently dynamic and is not creating enough jobs, which certainly everybody agrees about. And in terms of addressing the problems of the long-term unemployed in particular, which is what that chapter by Michael Strain, a great economist at the American Enterprise Institute, is focused on, the problems of the long-term unemployed, he suggests, can be addressed by creating better circumstances to overcome the problems that long-term unemployment itself creates for the people who are stuck in that situation. What he begins from is the evidence that shows that the fact of having been unemployed for a period of many months is itself a huge burden that people have to overcome in getting jobs, and you begin from that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a Republican effort to speak to the middle class and the new playbook of so-called reform conservatives. They've got a big manifesto out just 10 days ago or so called Room to Grow, Conservative Reform for Limited Government and a Thriving Middle Class. Their authors say the GOP needs a message beyond the party of no that will appeal to many Americans who will be deciding in the midterm elections and definitely in the 2016 presidential election which way they're going to turn after a long period of economic malaise here. Yuval Levin and Peter Wehner are with us, two of the co-authors of this big policy handbook. Bob Kuttner joins us a little later in this hour, a little pushback from a more liberal perspective. Peter, you were talking, Yuval, you were talking about long-term unemployment and what's proposed here. Give us a sense of a little bit of nitty-gritty about what you put out there.
So the proposal in that chapter written by Michael Strain basically focuses on four elements of how we can help the long-term unemployed. First of all, ways of making it easier for them to find work by allowing them to convert their unemployment benefit into a relocation benefit. The unemployment rate is obviously very different in different parts of the country, and by allowing people to move to where work is, if they choose, you can really allow the long-term unemployed to find to move themselves to places where there are a lot more opportunities, to making it easier to find work by lowering some of the licensing restrictions that make it difficult to enter a lot of different fields of employment in America.
You mean sort of small business things like, I don't know, food or like what?
Like, for example, to become a cosmetologist in Washington, D.C., you've got to go through 115 days of training. That's very difficult for the sort of person who's going to try to get into that field of work. And if you make it easier, you give people more opportunities to enter the workforce. So in both cases, these are ways of making it easier to find and get work. Second, he calls for making it easier for employers to hire the long-term unemployed. And in this case, that means a specific preference for long-term unemployed workers by allowing employers to pay them slightly less than the federal minimum wage and having the federal government make up the difference with a wage subsidy so that long-term unemployed workers become relatively more attractive, because right now the fact of their having on their resume months and maybe years out of work makes them relatively far less attractive, and there has to be a way of helping them back into the workforce. Third, ways of making it easier for employers to keep workers. And here the emphasis is on work sharing, which is an idea that's available to employers and employees in only a very few states that allows employers, when they have to cut back on labor costs, instead of reducing the size of the workforce, to reduce hours across the board so that people are essentially sharing full-time employment, at least for a period of time when the employer may be going through a difficult financial situation. So that it emphasizes the importance of keeping people in jobs and keeping them out of that unemployment pool that makes it so hard to get back into the workforce. And finally, he argues for making work more attractive. And here the emphasis is on expanding the earned income tax credit, which is a kind of alternative to the minimum wage that conservatives have always voiced support for. It was started under President Ford. It was vastly expanded under President Reagan and then again under President George W. Bush. And the EITC is basically a way to make work more attractive by making it pay better. It's a way for it's a kind of wage subsidy for lower-income families so that work is always more appealing than benefits you can get if you're unemployed. The danger with a lot of our safety net programs, as everybody I think acknowledges, is that they create a situation where perversely and unintentionally it's more attractive to be out of work than in work, because by taking a job you might lose some of your health care benefits that you get through Medicaid. You might lose some of the food stamp benefits you get or welfare benefits you get. The EITC is a way to bridge that gap so that work can be more attractive rather than less attractive.
Peter Weiner, jump in here if you would. I'm reading here Bill Galston in the Wall Street Journal saying, fine as far as it goes, and he's a conservative Republican, but he says, we may have structural problems that are deeper still than would be addressed with this kind of prescription, Peter. Is there a conservative plan to take on the deepest economic problems we're facing in your reform conservative agenda that would build just a better economic base under the middle class?
Yeah, just to correct, Bill is a conservative Democrat, not a conservative Republican.
Excuse me, of course,
And is a person both Yuval and I know and respect. Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, it's a complicated issue, and I would just put the frame around it, which is that the problems that are plaguing the middle class and America in general are not the result of any single party or president. There are some very deep, as you said, structural problems going on, and we see it manifest itself over the last decade and a half and longer in a whole series of ways, which has to do with wage stagnation and higher education costs and healthcare costs exploding and so forth and so on. So I just think it's important to say that. This is not a partisan or particularly political argument per se. So that's the first. In terms of
Does your party – Hillary Clinton's already talking about inequality. Many other people are as well. Do you think the GOP is going to embrace inequality as a problem? You've had prominent party members who just refuse to describe it that way.
Yeah, my view on the inequality is we should absolutely be willing to talk about it, but I think we have to talk about it in the right way. The conservative approach to inequality is that the issue isn't whether the 1% is doing well. It's whether the other 99% are doing well or not. Inequality per se can be good or bad, right? You can have inequality if all income levels are going up, but the highest income level is going up faster than the rest.
Well, some would say at great extremes it presents problems for democracy, because that very big money can buy outsized influence that then and we end up with policies that just go further in that direction and it just gets wider and wider.
Well, that's right. And we have examples in other countries where you have that kind of extreme gap. But it tends to be mostly a problem in a democracy when the middle class and the poor are doing extremely badly as opposed to the rich doing well. The second thing I would say is if you look at the most recent polling data from Gallup, income inequality is very near the bottom in terms of the concerns of the American people. But as I say, I don't have a problem conservatives talking about it. But I think the way that conservatives should properly talk about it is about social mobility. That is, giving middle class and low income people the skills and habits and help that they need to be able to rise. Because what we've seen, again, over not just years but decades, is stagnation. America has been known throughout its history as an upwardly mobile society. That's no longer the case. People now on the bottom rungs are stuck there. And I think that conservatives have an obligation to talk about what can be done for people in the middle class and for the lower middle class and for the poor to help them. I do believe that as a general matter, Republicans have not done that enough, particularly with the poor. I think as a general matter, again, that they've ignored it and they haven't put forward not only proposals to help them, but have ignored them by and large.
Of course, there's a question of whether people are stuck on those bottom rungs or falling to those bottom rungs out of a healthier middle class earlier because of Democrat or liberal policies or because of conservative Republican policies that may have shifted our overall policy posture in favor of them that has. Peter, let me and Yuval, let me begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was calling because as I was listening to your guests describe their plan, I'm curious to hear what their plan is, the modern conservative plan is for effective government. What I have heard again and again is that they want limited government or smaller government. Mm-hmm. But I never hear them talk about effective government. I absolutely understand that modern Republicans want a robust military. Honestly, so do Democrats. But then the government is more than just the military. When there are toxins in my food that I'm giving my kids, I expect the government to do something about it. I actually do want to make sure someone is watching Wall Street so they can't crush my house value again like they did 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I want my police and firefighters to be properly trained and have the resources that they need to help guard, you know, my community. I expect government to work properly, but I don't think that modern Republicans think that government should exist at all.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm not sure they're explaining.
Aaron, let us pick exactly that up. Yuval Levin, you can understand that. Grover Norquist was sure. So vivid in his description of making government so small that it could be drowned in the bathtub. Uh-huh. And that has kind of stuck to the GOP. What's the position on you hear exactly Aaron's question out of Omaha. How do you propose to get to effective government?
I think that concern and that question arises in part because Republicans in recent years have been so focused on the size of government and, as your caller says, have not focused on explaining to the public their vision of the role of government.
Well, drowning in the bathtub was one vision and a potent one out there.
Well, drowning in the bathtub is about size, right? What Grover Norquist says is that he wants government to be small enough that it could be drowned in a bathtub.
Size to the point of elimination.
Exactly. And the question is, what is the proper role of government? And as we're trying to suggest at the beginning, mm-hmm. conservatives tend to think that the role of the federal government in particular is to enable society to address its problems. Now, what does that mean in practice? What does that mean when you come down to specific issues? A lot of what it tends to mean is a different approach to thinking about what kind of knowledge and what kind of power is available to us in addressing public problems. So conservatives tend to think that rather than managing large systems, government should help society approach its problems through a process of problem solving, where first of all, you enable providers of services and benefits to try different ways of dealing with the problem. You enable citizens and consumers and recipients of benefits to choose among options.
So it's a kind of charter school approach in education and beyond.
Right, and then you enable the failures, the things that are not chosen, to go away, right? So it's experimentation, evaluation, evolution. That's what school choice and charter schools look like. That's what the conservative approach to healthcare looks like. That's what the conservative approach to higher education, in some respects, to the safety net looks like. It's a way of saying we don't know in advance how to solve every public problem. That's why we face these problems. And so what we need is a system that works from the bottom up based on how people confront these difficulties in their own lives, that gives people options, that gives them the power to choose, and that lets solutions arise from the bottom up. And that the government should exist to enable that kind of process to function, to direct public resources in such a way that people have the power to choose. So, for example, again, giving lower-income parents the kind of choices in schools for their children that higher-income parents have always had. It means creating a competitive market that is regulated, where competition is fair, as your caller suggested. There's definitely a role for government in sustaining the marketplace as a arena for fair competition, rather than as a place that provides benefits only to the biggest players and the best connected players. And so again and again, in issue after issue, the way to approach the problem and to use public resources is to enable solutions to arise at the level that problems are confronted. And in practice, what that means in healthcare, what it means in education, what it means in employment and in the safety net is what this book tries to lay out, which is, again, creating competitive systems that allow us in an ongoing incremental way to solve problems by using the dynamic economy that we have rather than by trying to substitute government for it in ways that at the end of the day are just too big for any centrally organized system to be able to manage. That's why the vision of government that the liberal welfare state advances, as I think your caller is suggesting, often just doesn't work. And the question is, how can government work, not just how much should we spend on it?
Peter Wehner, along with that question out of Omaha, was this concern that, you know, how do you give people confidence that what we're talking about here is not just a kind of return or move to a Darwinian jungle with huge winners and millions of losers?
Well, the way you do it is by articulating what your vision of government and your agenda is, and secondly, by having people step up in the Republican Party and the conservative movement who can make the case in a somewhat winsome and reassuring manner. Look, Grover Norquist's fine. I've criticized Grover for his comment. Mm-hmm. I think he made it 15 or 20 years ago.
It's hung around, though. It's stuck around as an idea.
It has hung around. I think it's hung around because a lot of people on the left have grabbed onto it. Now, I'm not a libertarian. I'm happy to criticize it. But to be fair, you can't name leaders in the Republican Party, lawmakers or governors who have argued for the complete elimination of government.
But the theme has not been foreign to the Tea Party movement, which has been very strong in the Obama years by any measure.
I agree, and you would be hard-pressed to find a Republican or a conservative who has had more critical things to say about the Tea Party than I have. I believe, and I've written often, that it's not enough to talk just about the size. You have to talk about the efficacy. But I want to push back a little bit here. We've got to put aside the caricatures if we're going to actually move forward. Now, I do think that as a general matter, that there is a disposition within some elements of the conservative conservative movement and Tea Party to be too ferociously anti-government. Interestingly, my critique is that they are rhetorically much too extreme, and when it comes to policy, actually somewhat timid. And I'll give you a specific example.
Okay.
In 2012, Michelle Bachmann, who was a GOP presidential candidate, gave speech after speech eviscerating the federal government. Never had anything positive to say about it. Continually talked about how it had to get smaller. But when she was asked for specifically about Medicare reforms being put forward by Paul Ryan, which would have inserted market forces into Medicare premium support and so forth, she actually balked and she was not in favor of it. So here you had a situation in which she talked in fairly radical measures about government. But when it came to a responsible policy to try and relimit government, make it more effective, more efficient, more modern, more aligned to the realities of life in the 21st century, she didn't go forward with it. So I do think that there's a problem. I think there's a tonal problem, and I think that there is a kind of disposition among some on the right. They go under the name of constitutional conservatives who seem to think that the government post-New Deal is unconstitutional, and they want to roll it back. I think that's a problem politically, and I think it's a problem philosophically.
Are they listening to you now in the interest of winning federal elections, or is there still some trench warfare going on there?
Well, look, I think it's a debate that's going on, and it's a fairly passionate debate. But as I said earlier, my sense is that lawmakers, people in leadership and in Congress, and also potential presidential candidates are listening, because I think that they understand on some deeper level than they did that the problems plaguing the Republican Party are fairly systemic. I would say that they are somewhat akin to the problems facing the Democratic Party pre-Bill Clinton and the British Labor Party pre-Tony Blair. That is, it's going to require a Republican to rise up who can make some fairly fundamental shifts to the party, and to signal to the public that the party is different than it has been. And we'll see if somebody is going to emerge.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a Republican effort to speak to the middle class anew, and the new playbook of so-called reform conservatives. It's called Room to Grow, 100-plus pages of agenda items for any Republican to pick up and run with if they will. They may have plenty of inspiration to do that. Democrats talking a lot about inequality. Republicans, you can see in the polls, have become associated with the wealthy in recent years, with inequality problems. Hillary Clinton jumping that already, even before any kind of announcement of running for president, talking about her new book, Hard Choices, in the last couple of days. Here she was talking about the cancer of inequality.
I think that people will see that we are strong and well-equipped to restore prosperity here at home, to deal with the cancer of inequality, to give people in our country the ladders of opportunity that have always been a hallmark of the United States and the American dream.
Hillary Clinton talking there. And, of course, the we she's referring to is the Democratic Party. Here's Eric Cantor, House Majority Leader, Republican, of course, involved with the group that's putting out this new manifesto saying, you've got to have room for mobility in this country. You'd like Republicans to lead that charge.
The core of America, the working middle class families, are facing some serious problems. And it's about their outlook and their faith in the future and whether that they can see a better life for themselves and their kids. And I think, as you point out, overwhelmingly, the signs indicate that they don't have that sense that they will enjoy upward mobility.
And when it comes election time, everybody wants to be broadcasting that. Yuval Levin and Peter Wehner join us from Washington, two of the co-authors this fat book of policy prescriptions I've got on the table right here. You can join us as well. Yuval, Peter, stand by for a moment. Robert Kuttner joins us right now from Boston, co-founder, co-editor of The American Prospect, senior fellow at the Demos Research and Policy Think Tank, author of many books, including Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. Robert Kuttner, you've been listening. You've thumbed through what they're putting on the griddle here for American voters to think about. What do you see, Bob?
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. You know, I was listening, and I was reminded of an episode from my youth when New York Mayor Robert Wagner ran as a reform candidate against his own previous administration. As you said in your introduction, the founders of the Young Gun Network include Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Mitch McConnell was at the rollout. So I'm not sure how reformist this is, except to the extent that the authors recognize that Republicans have a problem, that they need to signal concern for the middle class, especially in an election year, and I guess that qualifies you as a reformer. So I salute Peter and Yuval for admitting that most voters don't believe Republicans care about the middle class, but I think the voters are right. And if you look at the particulars in the manifesto, it's mostly the same stuff that Republicans have been promoting since Reagan's supply-side economics and Gingrich's contract with America and George W. Bush's compassion conservatism dressed up with some new packaging. But when the subject turns to remedies, you know, it's more tax cuts, more tax credits for everything from health insurance to education, more deregulation, more vouchers, more cuts in social support. So I don't think the substance changes very much, plus the fact that as the price of keeping the government open and as the price of not defaulting on the national debt, the Republican House has insisted on $5 trillion in budget cuts, $5 trillion over the next 10 years. So where are you going to get the money, whether it's tax credits or vouchers or EITC or anything else? I mean, to read this, you'd think that liberals had been in charge since 1981, when in fact conservatives have been in charge more often than not, and when Democrats have been in charge, they've been Democrats either moving to the right deliberately, tactically, or Democrats handcuffed by the right's blockade.
But Robert Kuttner, wouldn't it behoove liberals, maybe liberals like yourself, at some point to give an open ear to this? I mean, this is an opening. It's less ideologically hard bar than a lot of what we've heard. They're consciously trying to change the tone and something more than that here. I mean, if everybody digs in, where do we end up as a country?
Well, you know, I read this really carefully.
Yeah.
And, there are a few things in there that I could support. For instance, I was pleased to see that they came out against too big to fail banks.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the financial crisis and the Great Recession that followed was precisely the fruit of deregulation sponsored by Republicans and, unfortunately, colluded in by some Democrats. Look at the proposal for work sharing. It's a great idea. It was invented by German social democrats. It requires government to subsidize part of most of the loss that workers take by dropping to 70% or 80% of full time,
yeah.
And it's collectively bargained. So,
but they're making that proposal. So wouldn't you say, hey, let's talk about it?
Yeah, but Tom, I think the point is there's about 10% of this that I think represents constructive movement. But honestly, really, 90% of it is the same stuff in new packaging.
Peter Wehner, respond to the same stuff in new packaging critique.
Yeah, I just disagree. I mean, I think there are policies that haven't been implemented, and that's one of the key arguments. Some of these policies, just because policies have been put forward before, doesn't make them necessarily bad. What matters is the merits of them, and in many cases, the conservative reforms that we're putting forward have not put into to place.
Take us to one or two that we haven't discussed that you think might fill that bill, and are still waiting on the shelf to save the middle class. If you could roll them out.
Well, I'd say, for example, on higher education, I think it's an interesting chapter. And this is an issue, for example, where Republicans in the 2012 presidential race said more about electrified fences on the southern border than they did about higher education.
What would you like to hear? What's Andrew Kelly proposing here in the book?
More flexibility in accreditation, so you let more players in the field, more data about outcomes. Reforms of the student loan system, so you reframe some of the inflationary pressures. Some disclosure of information on how graduation rates fare in the labor market, income sharing agreement.
Okay.
So those are some on education. But let me say, Robert Kuttner, for all due respect, we don't expect him to endorse our proposals because he's a man of the left. And because he's a man of the left, he's coming at this from a different philosophical perspective. We think he's wrong. He thinks he's right. That's fine. But we're not looking for an endorsement from him. The second thing is he was saying that Republicans speak as if they haven't been in power for many years. I guess I would flip the table a little bit and say that sometimes liberals speak as if Barack Obama hasn't been in power for the last 5.5 years.
But look,
years.
Here's the thing. I take your point, but I think most Americans are ultimately not rigidly ideological. They're looking for things that will work, and they certainly see problems in front of us right now.
I understand, which is why we put forward this book and why we're having this conversation. I'm just reacting. You had Bob Kuttner on earlier, and I'm responding in a specific way to he said. Let me take, for example, income inequality, which I've told you. I think that is an issue Republicans should talk about. I think that they should talk about it in the context of social mobility. I think one of the key issues when it comes to social mobility is education, and I think the left has a tremendous amount to answer for, not just in public policy, but in human costs, in terms of their opposition to things like charter schools, like de Blasio in New York, or school choice, which would help the lowest income kids, and that kind of thing. So, if one wants to get into a debate on compassion, which I'm happy to do as well, I think that these policies would be better. And I'll stop with one last general point, which is I think that the problem with the left is there's a kind of reactionary liberalism. They are defending programs like Social Security and Medicare, some of which were created before the middle part of the last century, some a little bit after. But they refused to favor, and in fact, they attack anybody that wants to make reforms that would modernize the programs, bring them up to speed in the 21st century, take into account the current demographic realities. I actually think that liberalism itself is exhausted, and that there is a moment here for conservatives to rise up.
I didn't see a prescription for Social Security
may I respond on that?
Well, just 1 second, Bob. Absolutely, but. Is there a specific plan in your manifesto for what you would recommend on Social Security?
No, this is Social Security reforms have been put forward. This particular manifesto has 10 policy areas, some health care, higher education, lower education, and many others. It couldn't cover – it didn't cover immigration as well. So some issues weren't there. But Social Security reforms have been put forward by conservatives, including President Bush. So it is not as if that issue hasn't been addressed by Republicans.
Look, when we talk about economics on this show, we often have a good debate. We had Thomas Piketty on recently and Gregory Mankiw on to work it through with him. Bob Kuttner, what about exhaustion of liberalism here when you look at a reform conservative agenda?
Well, take Social Security and education. You know, until the 1980s, public higher education was basically free. It was the great avenue of upward mobility for the lower class, the middle class. Conservatives got into power. They cut state budgets, and tuitions were increased, fees were increased. And instead of getting free public education, students had to take on loans, over $1 trillion worth now. When the Obama administration has tried to reform that, conservatives have blocked reform. I want to quote one thing they say on Social Security. They say Social Security has crowded out the traditional effort, the traditional incentive to raise children as a protection against poverty in old age. In other words, the idea is have lots of kids. I go back to the 19th century world where parents spawn large families as insurance against destitution in old age. Most Americans wouldn't support that. I mean, young adults are suffering downward mobility as it is trying to raise families, and do we really want to add the burden of supporting aging parents? So I think there are some programs that are rock-solid parts of the American consensus, such as Social Security and Medicare and higher education that you can afford. It's not that liberals are going backwards. It's that liberals represent what most Americans believe in.
Let's go to Arlington, Texas, and Barbara. Barbara, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I am a fiscally conservative Democrat.
Okay.
And the reason that I don't vote Republican and the reason many of my upper and middle class women friends don't vote Republican is not because of fiscal policy, but because of women's rights. We feel that we're beat up on abortion and a number of other issues. And so it doesn't really matter to us what you come up with from the fiscal perspective. We need you to get in line and treat women equally.
And are you talking abortion in particular or wage equality? What's the breadth of your agenda there, Barbara?
Abortion is a big one, but it just seems to us that women in the Republican Party don't have a terribly big voice, and that's a huge concern.
Yuval Levin, speak to that. Barbara sounds like, you know, she might be winnable over if with the right message. She's pretty leery, though.
Well, let me speak to that, and let me also speak to some of what Bob has said. First of all, the Republican Party has certainly become a more pro-life party, and the American public has become more pro-life as well, as we've come to know more facts about the beginnings of life. And I don't think I am a pro-life person myself, and I would never suggest that the Republican Party, in order to win voters, should give up on its principles, let alone on the core American principles that we are all created equal. And so I would not be happy to see the Republican Party move on abortion, though I certainly think we have to do a better job of making the case, the moral case, person by person, neighbor by neighbor, about abortion. I think that's a moral issue, and I think that the Republican Party is in the right place on that issue. But I do want to say, I mean, first of all, the quote that Bob used to suggest that there's some kind of attack on Social Security here is just entirely out of context. It comes from a chapter that is about tax reform to allow parents to keep more of what they earn while they have children in the home. I think it's simply a fact that our entitlement system is designed in a way that taxes parents twice. And what the proposal here does is try to make up for some of that, and only some of it, by allowing working families to keep more of what they earn. I think more generally, there are two important things to understand about where these ideas are positioned in the left-right context mm-hmm. and in the intra-conservative context. First of all, the background here, it seems to me, is not simply that conservatives are exhausted on policy and need to readdress themselves to the public. It's that both parties are exhausted. And in that sense, this is a different moment than the mid-1980s when the Democrats had to retool themselves. Because we're in a situation where the public is not satisfied with either party, and rightfully so. Mm. The Democrats, as you heard from Bob, are under the impression that it is always 1965. The Republicans, as you hear from most Republicans, are under the impression that it is always 1981. And they're both wrong. And they're wrong in ways that mean that they have a lot of trouble speaking to the actual concerns of the public. That's why this book tries to start with those concerns and to think about where American society has gone. We've moved from a place where American life is defined by the interaction of big institutions, big government, big business, big labor, big media, big universities, to increasingly a place where American life is defined by the interaction of an incredible variety of smaller institutions and networks and communities. And that creates a lot of opportunities. It also creates a lot of challenges.
What if we're in a structural situation, Yuval, that just doesn't bring in the wages that you need to keep a healthy middle class? I mean, our listeners, listen carefully here. Here's one on Twitter saying, you know, what's the average wage of a cosmetologist in Washington, D.C., you mentioned earlier? And another is saying here, I don't see the economy as insufficiently dynamic. It's just that all the dynamism goes now to automation, requiring fewer workers. How does the small government footprint work, and if that's the kind of world we're moving into, Yuval?
Well, if that's the kind of world we're moving into, the problem we're facing now is that our public programs, our government system, are not going through the same transition that everything else is going through. And so we're trying to force a mid-20th century big institution dynamic on an increasingly decentralized economy. And part of what we're arguing is that government itself needs to function in a more decentralized way to try to build on the potential of this kind of decentralization and to protect people from the risks, which are very real. And in that sense, that means that benefits have to travel with people and should not be tied to employment on the assumption that you're going to keep the same job for your whole career. It means that people should be able to address problems at the level at which they confront them, should be able to function as consumers as they do in every other part of their life when it comes to public benefits. We need modernization, and both parties badly need it. The Democrats, in that sense, are in much worse shape than the Republicans.
Bob Kuttner, you ready to look a little beyond the Great Society here, new agendas for new century?
Sure, but I don't think the liberal agenda is exhausted. I mean, I think people want decent incomes. Most of the productivity gains have gone to the top. That requires public policies, and people want to protect and expand social insurance. I don't think that's exhausted. So, you know, if the right feels their agenda is exhausted, I can say, you know, aye to that. But I don't think the liberal agenda is by any means exhausted.
Bob Kuttner with the American Prospect. Appreciate your being with us today, Bob. Yuval Levin and Peter Wehner, I hope we can keep talking as this political season heats up over the next couple of years. It's great to have you with us today. The new manifesto is Room to Grow. Yuval, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Wehner, thanks so much for being with us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.